day of 34 today, and 34 and 35 are companions, but we will do 35 next week because it will lead us into 36 and 37 and 38, which we will perhaps finish next fall unless you all want to go for the whole month of April, which of course I can. So following this first verse is a call to the nations and peoples to listen. So let's read this first verse together. Come near, you nations, and listen. Pay attention, you peoples. Let the earth hear and all that is in it, the world and all that comes out of it. And what are they supposed to hear? Verse 2. The Lord is angry with all nations. His wrath is on their armies. He will totally destroy them. He will give them over to slaughter. And we'll read the rest of that in a few minutes. This cannot be a comfortable... Is this awfully loud? Yeah, I think so too. I think I can't do anything about it. I'll try to talk low.
It's not too bad.
Okay. Following this call to the nations and people to listen, the very next verse and through verse 4, which we didn't read, Isaiah announces the Lord's anger against both earth and heaven. And judgment proceeds from the very nature of God. That's a real hard thing to think about. If our God is holy, then he must hate anything that is not holy. If he is love, then he must, in order to defend that love, he must come against that which hurts that love. And so that's where wrath comes from, out of his nature. And I thought we might look for a minute at the characteristics of God, which the theological term is attributes, and those that he is in and of himself alone. And those are called his immutable attributes. And his immutable attributes are those we don't share. For instance, he is eternal. He is also omnipotent, meaning he is all-powerful. What else is he that we don't share?
Omnipresent.
He is omnipresent. He is everywhere at once. What else is he? That's a good one. He is omniscient. All the omnis. He is omniscient. He knows all things. What else is he?
Loving.
But he shares loving with us.
Oh, just for him.
This is just what he does in and of himself that we don't share. He is holy. The thing about God's holiness, well, and there's another one let's get before that. He is righteous. He is purely righteous. And he is holy. Now, the interesting thing about this holiness is that it is the only attribute in the Bible that the Bible mentions three times. And what does that mean to us? It is the supreme holiness. Whereas in English you have good, better, best. Judy gets up in the morning and she's lovely. But she puts on her makeup and she's lovelier. And she puts on her ball gown and she is the loveliest. I mean, you know, so you've got lovely, lovelier, loveliest. Well, Hebrew and Greek don't have an ability to do that. So they do it by repetition. Anything mentioned twice is important. I say to you, amen, amen. It means shape up and pay attention. If I say to you, Peter, Peter, Satan desires to sift you as wheat. This is really important, Peter, your name said twice. Only one thing is mentioned three times, and that is that the Lord is
holy, holy,
holy, holy. So he is holy, holy, holy. There is nothing as holy as he is. And yet there's a command. Be ye holy, even as I am holy. How is that possible?
Redeemed.
oh good girl, through Christ. It is not our holiness, it is His imputed holiness to us. Well, and the same with righteousness, but it's not because it's ours. And this is my favorite example, and that is that this white jacket is Christ's holiness or His righteousness. And because we are sinners, can we have red scarlet sins? Will you be my red? Would you? Not you, but will just your red. So the red scarlet sins, we're told. I know. Oh, yeah. But isn't, I mean, if it's going to fit mine, it's good. Thank you for being my analogy all day today. You're so good.
But it's yes. True, I was full of sin, but now I'm covered with God's.
All right, so, but none of us are good in and of ourselves, but we are covered with Christ's righteousness. Because they say, though our sins be as scarlet, they be washed white as snow because of Jesus. So, thank you, Angela. You've just been so glad you came today. I mean, so, but God's righteousness and His holiness are going to impact His love. They're also going to impact His wrath and everything else. So none of these qualities, none of these characteristics, none of these attributes are by themselves. They're all in balance. When we want to talk about them, we break them out. But God's a whole. So please, you know, I want to keep saying this. This is all whole. He is eternally omnipotent. He's eternally omnipresent. He's eternally omniscient. He's eternally all of these things. And yet, He's omnipotent. He's omnipotent eternally. He's omnipotent because He's omnipresent. See, and it just gets so complicated that we think, if we can simplify it, we can talk about it. But then we tend to take away from some of the truth of it. So please don't make this too delineated. Now, what does He share with us? When He made man, He said, let us make man in our own image. And in the image of God, He made them both man and woman. So what did He share? Are we eternal? We're not. Can we be everywhere at once? Do we know everything? Are we all powerful? Do we think we are? Okay. He shares with us the fact that we can be loving. He shares with us the fact that we can be angry. We have wrath. He shares with us the fact that we can be merciful. What else does He share with us? Yes, He shares with us. We'll just throw them in there as the fruit of the Spirit. Kindness, patience, perseverance. Well, let's just put them up there anyway. Wisdom, which we know we get straight from Him. But these are qualities of God, and I do a sun because sort of it radiates out to us. So this is, so He is love, but is He love, love, love? No, He's only holy, holy, holy. So what kind of love does God have? He has holy love, perfect love. Do we have perfect love? Yipes, no. It's because it's so high. Okay, thank you. He has perfect mercy. He has perfect kindness. There's a word in the Hebrew, hesed, which means, that's a C, which means loving kindness. So the loving kindness of the Lord never ceases, but loving kindness also involves mercy. That's much better. Also involves mercy. But when the translators translate hesed, sometimes they just pick one of those words, but they're all together. It's one word. It's one characteristic. Isn't that cool? Loving kindness and mercy is all in hesed, one word. C-H-E-S-E-D. In the Hebrew, it's hesed. Hesed. I can't quite get that out. The C-H. Hesed. There is a word for mercy, there's a word for kindness, and there's a word for them, four words for love. But you know that when you see them all together, if they say loving kindness, you know that, the loving kindness of the Lord never ceases. You know that that word is hesed and includes mercy. Okay? So if these are all the qualities of God and his characteristics, when we get to his wrath, it's holy wrath. And as I've told you before, it's not hot anger. It is a deliberate decision of the will. Because it is coming against all the unrighteousness and godliness of man. Romans 1:18, the wrath of God is being revealed against all the godlessness and wickedness of men, and which particular men? Those who suppress the truth by their wickedness. And this is the truth of God. And then Paul goes on to talk about how men know the truth, both through their conscience and through seeing it through nature, because you see nature, you know you didn't create it, so it forces you to look at God. He puts a conscience inside you. You know things aren't fair. What's the standard of fair? It's what God set. Everybody innately has a feeling, hey, that's not fair. And so that's the conscience. So they suppress that truth by their wickedness. And then it goes on to talk about what they do in Romans 1. So the eternality of this wrath, it's eternal too. So look over here. This summons to hear the coming judgment is not the Lord's first word to the world. It's not even his first word and warning to the world about that wrath. But in Isaiah, that first warning came in the chapter before. And it came in verse 14 in chapter 33 when he said, the sinners of Zion are terrified. Trembling grips the godless. Who can dwell? Who of us can dwell in the trembling fire? Who of us can dwell with everlasting burning? So he's already beginning to talk about it in the verse before. And then in 15 he says, he who walks righteously and speaks what is right, who rejects gain from extortion and keeps his hand from accepting bribes, who stops his ears against plots of murder and shuts his eyes against the contemplating evil, that person is the one who understands what sin is. What psalm should this remind you of? Psalm 1. Let's go to Psalm 1. The very first psalm opens the hymn book. Blessed is the man who does not walk in the counsel of the wicked, or stand in the way of sinners, or sit in the seat of mockers. But his delight is in the law of the Lord, and on his law he meditates day and night. What happens if you do that? He is like a tree planted by streams of water, which yields its fruit in season, whose leaf does not wither. Whatever he does prospers. Not so the wicked. They are like the chaff that the wind blows away. Therefore, the wicked will not stand in the judgment, nor sinners in the assembly of the righteous. For the Lord watches over the way of the righteous, but the way of the wicked will perish. When was this written? Who wrote it? When did David live? I gave you my cheat sheet. Yes, 1,000 B.C. When was Isaiah? 700 700. So 300 years later, Isaiah picks up what they already knew in Psalm 1. So when I say to you, God has been telling them this, we can see it just right here. And this is in the Psalms, is the hymn book, so that you know they've been over it and over it and over it in worship. If they never saw it anyplace else, then in verse 24, God brings back the idea of the message of forgiveness. No one living in Zion will say, I am ill, and the sins of those who dwell there will be forgiven. Now, is this I am ill physical illness? No, it's not. What is it? It's sin, because he defines it in the next line. If you say, I am ill, and the sins... Remember, Jesus would say to someone, what do you want me to do for you? And they would say, I want to be healed. And he'd say, your sins are forgiven. Because that is the first healing. Physical healing is only incidental to that healing. So we don't want to take these things out of context and say God doesn't mean for us to be sick. That is absolutely not not the way God works. So in looking at this wrath that God is going to bring against them, the world must hear what the Lord has done for Zion, because the same salvation reaches out to the ends of the earth. But should they not respond to the standard of the law of God, which gives them what? If you uphold to the standard of the law of God, what do you have? You've got righteous behavior, don't you? That follows in what God says. You have... And then you hear the message of forgiveness for sin. So then you have been cleansed. But if you don't pay attention to this, is this not the gospel? The bad news is that we're sinners. The good news is we're forgiven and set right with God through Jesus Christ. But that same message was in the Old Testament. This is not the Old Testament. Is in the New Testament revealed, remember? So what happens if this gospel call to recognize your sin, to straighten it up by the law of God, and then to be forgiven for your sin, turn to God to be forgiven, what happens if this call goes unheeded by the world? Because the gospel call man ignores. What happens if men ignore that gospel? Judgment happens, but wrath happens. Because wrath is why judgment is. Judgment is the result of wrath. God's wrath exists against all wickedness and ungodliness of men. So the wrath is out there. If you move out from under that circle of God's protection, which is what this is, the standard of the law of God and the message of forgiveness, you move out from under that, all that's out here is wrath. Does that make sense? This is where you have protection and you move out from under it, and that's where the wrath of God is. And girls, I submit to you that that's where the world is. They're out from under his protection. So now with all of that as background, let's look at the rest of this part of Isaiah. So Isaiah is now going to say, verse 2. Now remember NIV, I've told you, for some reason, leaves off the word for. And it's right here. There are four places here where they leave it out, but I want to put it in for us to read it. What does the word for mean? It means because. Because. Okay, so the Lord is angry at the world and all that comes out of that. Because the Lord is angry with all nations, his wrath is on all their armies. And this particular word for anger means a sharp burst of anger. And his wrath is on all their armies. And this is abiding animosity. Thank you. Yeah. abiding animosity. He will totally destroy them. He will give them over to slaughter. To totally destroy, this is a place of segregation and judgment. The context of it is the removal from further human contact of that which is so appalling that it must at once be consigned to God for his decision. So he's going to just totally take it out of all human context. He will give them over to slaughter, and this is the death due to sin and sinners. Their slain will be thrown out. Their dead bodies will stink. It's lovely, isn't it? The mountains will be soaked with their blood. And this means melted by a new and dreadful soil erosion through which the blood has stained the soil. So the earth is condemned because of man's sin. Where did we see this begin? In the garden. Because God cursed the earth. And we know that in the new heaven, in the new earth, that the earth will be renewed. But he's pointing out here how the sin of the nations and then the individuals and the environment. So in here, he will totally destroy them. He'll give them over to slaughter. He's talking about the nations. Their stain will be thrown out. Their dead bodies will stink. Here he's talking about individuals. All the stars and the sky will be dissolved. And this word dissolved means delayed or rotted, an internal corruption working destruction. So this is an internal disruption, internal corruption. It's inside of it. So now we have nature. So we had the nations, the individual. Here is the environment. And the heavens rolled up like a scroll. The Lord is going to determine when the story is finished, and he's going to close the book. And all the starry host will fall. And this word fall means to fade. So the inner forces of life and light are going to be gone. Now, has this happened completely yet? No, it hasn't. It hasn't happened completely yet, but it certainly seemed to happen when the Assyrians came against Israel, and certainly then when the Assyrians came against Judah. Judgment proceeds from the nature of God, and because God is a holy God, and his holiness is a positive against sin, there's a crying need for salvation. Earth and heaven alike are caught up in this final judgment. All stems out of his holiness. All stems out of his judgment against sin. So therefore, how should we feel about this wrath? Well, we should fear it, but as opposed to feeling like it's, I guess the world wants to talk about it, or our culture wants to talk about it, if they talk about it at all, that it's, we don't believe in a God of wrath. We only believe in a God of love. But is it possible for him to be a God of love and not be a God of wrath? That's correct. But what I'm trying to get to you, Angela, today is not the doing, it's who he is. If he is a God of love and sin is hurting his people whom he loves, then in order to love his people, he must be a God of wrath. Okay, do you see that? It does. It does break his heart. He does not do this lightly. So let's look at Romans 1. Let's look at Romans 1:18 and look at what Paul says about this. And then we'll come back to Isaiah. Because I think what I want you to see here is once again the continuing consistency of the Bible, particularly on something this important. the wrath of God, verse 18, is being revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and wickedness of men who suppress the truth by their wickedness. Since what may be known about God is plain to them because God made it plain to them. So nobody can say, God never told me. What about the native and deepest, darkest Africa? How can he be held to account? Here's how. For since the creation of the world, God's invisible qualities, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen. Well, how have his qualities and nature been clearly seen? Through nature itself. We know we didn't make the world. Being understood from what has been made, so that men are without excuse. Although they knew God, they neither glorified him as God or gave thanks to him, but their thinking became futile and their foolish hearts were darkened. Here is where we are now. We have foolish thinking. We think we know it all. And our hearts are darkened. That means we aren't looking at the light. So what light are we not looking at? We're not looking at God. We're looking at ourselves. We've turned this around and made man the center. And so because we're not looking at what God says, we are fools. Although they claimed to be wise, think about this, although they claimed to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the immortal God for images made to look like mortal man and birds and animals and reptiles. So do we not worship man? Do we not worship our way of doing things? You know, we do. And if we were doing Romans, we'd take all these words apart. But I think we can just look at them and see this is the same thing Isaiah is talking about. Paul is bringing it up here. And it's still the same 700 years later when he's writing. It's still the same 2,100 years later. Therefore, here is the wrath of God. God gave them over. And that's the most, those are the worst words you can think of. Because what it means is God takes his hand off that is protecting them. And the idea that what he does is our nature is like bricks. It's like clay. And the world is like sun, hot sun around it. And it will bake the clay and make it hard. And if God takes his hand off, then your heart will become hardened because that's the nature of the heart. As it turns from God. And so it is so sad to hear these words. God gave them over. God. It's an intrinsic hardening. Because it's what it is. And what does he give them over to? The sinful desires of their hearts. Two. And the first one is sexual impurity. Why is sexual impurity the first sin? Oh, good girl. Because we're made in the image of God. This is exactly what we're talking about here. Made in his image. To have these characteristics influenced by his eternal characteristics. And if we sin, we sin against the image that God created us to be. Therefore, we sin against him in the most intimate way. So that's the first sin. For the degrading of their bodies with one another. So how you hold your body in respect and regard is critical. The Old Testament teaches this all the time. Guard your hearts. What else does it tell you about your body? That we know that it is the temple of the Holy Spirit. They exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshipped and served created things rather than to the Creator who is to be forever praised. Amen. And then we could go over all the other sins, but we'll stop right there. Because this takes us right to where he's talking in Isaiah. Right to what he's coming against. Okay? All right, so then back to Isaiah 34, and we're going to be in verse 5. So the starry host will fall like withered leaves from the vine. Harvest time has come, and the harvest has been reaped. And so now you just have the withered vine leaves. So this is when the stars fall. This is a harvest of the stars. We haven't seen this yet, have we? Like shriveled figs from the fig tree. When will this harvest come? This harvest of the wrath of God? At the end times. But we see pictures of it as we go through, you know, history, do we not? And so he does show and tells to tell us it's really coming. This is what it's going to look like, so we won't miss it. My sword has drunk its fill in the heavens. See, it descends in judgment on Edom, the people I have totally destroyed. Edom is presented as a case in point. And throughout all the Old Testament, Edom is seen as opposing the peace of people of God, particularly Genesis 32 and 36. So where did Edom come from? A little background. Esau. Edom are the people of Esau, and Esau was the brother of Jacob. And so we saw Jacob become the righteous brother and Esau become the unrighteous brother, and they fought, the two peoples fought all the way through the Old Testament. And Edom actually, when the people of God were coming in through the desert, they wanted to go through Edom, and Edom wouldn't let them. And so God cursed them at that point. As Jacob and Esau struggled as brothers for the birthright, Edom in Canaan was Esau's home. For the sword of the Lord is bathed in blood. Because the sword of the Lord is bathed in blood. It's four. There's a four there and there's a four here. It is covered with fat, the blood of lambs and goats, fat from the kidneys and rams. So what is this supposed to be? The blood of goats and lambs, the kidneys of rams covered in fat. What is that supposed to bring to your mind? The sacrifice of the Old Testament. It is. And here's another four here. For the Lord has a sacrifice in Bozrah and the great slaughter in the land of Edom. So Bozrah is a city in Edom 30 miles southwest of the Dead Sea. The appointed way in which the demands of the divine holiness of God were to be met was through these sacrifice.
30 miles southwest.
The Dead Sea. So why would he use specific geographic places? They know them. Plus, he's bringing in what's really happening. You know, when we look at this now, it's not really happening now. But it was in their time. So it just intensified, God bless you, you know, what was going on. Okay. And the wild oxen will fall with them, the bull calves and the great bulls. When they talk about wild ox and wild oxen, how was Esau himself described? He was described as a wild ox, wasn't he, and a wild man. So these are the leaders of Edom are following in the same characteristics that Esau had, that they're going to be wild oxen. And so here are the Edomites. They're going to fall, and the bull calves and the great bulls, and their land is going to be drenched with blood. So he's coming against the enemies of Israel. This is his wrath. Remember, first he said the nations, the peoples, the nations, the individuals, and then the universe. And the dust will be soaked with fat. So sacrifices won't do them any good because his wrath is going to come. Verse 8, for the Lord has a day of vengeance. And they put in the four here. The day of the Lord is the time when the Lord establishes his kingdom on earth by delivering and glorifying his saints and by punishing the wicked and the oppressors of his children. And that's a definition you should have. I'll repeat it. The day of the Lord is the time when God establishes his kingdom on earth, what did the apostles continue to ask Jesus? When will your kingdom come? When will you establish it on earth? It's in two parts. They thought it would be one part. Jesus came in the flesh and he died and he will come again. They thought this meant once. It's actually an ongoing situation for us now. By delivering and glorifying his saints, by punishing the wicked and the oppressors of his children. Did you get all that?
No.
Okay, where'd you stop?
By delivering.
And glorifying his saints.
Glorifying saints.
And punishing the wicked and the oppressors of his children. Okay. The sacrifice required by divine holiness, which was verses 6 and 7 when we described the blood and the fat, is also the exact requital of human merits. A year of retribution to uphold Zion's cause. As Edom versus Zion throughout the Old Testament, Zion has a just cause against Edom, and that cause can be left to him to whom vengeance belongs. God's saying, leave it to me, to whom vengeance belongs. Edom's streams will be turned into pitch. Now, this is alluding to the fall of Sodom and Gomorrah when we're talking about pitch and blazing pitch in Genesis 19:24 and 28. So in verses 9 and 10, we're going to get a picture of divine judgment, the blighted environment, and then the perpetual results. So the blighted environment, the streams are going to be turned into pitch. What is pitch? It is tar, and it's black. Her dust into burning sulfur. Her land will become a blazing pitch. What happened to Sodom and Gomorrah as they were fleeing from it? Sulfur fell from the ground, fell from the sky, sulfur and pitch. Tar and sulfur fell, remember? And so he's saying what happened to Sodom and Gomorrah is going to happen to Edom. And of course, if you were familiar with your Old Testament and you read this, you'd say, I know what that is. It will not be quenched by night or day. So this is both points to God's judgment as everlasting, night and day, and then later from generation to generation. So what form is this written in? Is this a history book? It's poetry. And you know it's poetry because it's in this little squished section. You know it's not written all the way out, so you know that it's Hebrew poetry. But also, it is going to repeat itself. So here are our repetitions. The blazing pitch turned into pitch, and then it will be not quenched night or day. Its smoke, so the burning sulfur is going to have smoke. So here are the poetic forms to make you understand it. Her land will become a blazing pitch. We've got pitch up here. And it will not be quenched night or day or from generation to generation. Both of these talk about the fact that it's going on forever. It will lie desolate. No one will ever pass through it again. So in this wrath, God is going to totally destroy the enemies. Divine judgment. No one will pass through it again. Humans will disappear. No ordinary events of life will occur. And what is going to happen to the land? We've heard this over and over and over again from the beginning of Isaiah. The desert owl and the screech owl will possess it. The incoming of the wild beasts. Remember how we've talked all along about how the fertile fields are going to go fallow and the beasts will live in it. There won't be any cattle and the sheep will run off and there won't be anything for them to eat and it'll all be briars. This is all coming back into this chapter. The great owl and the raven will nest there. God will stretch out over Edom the measuring line of chaos and the plumb line of desolation. All this happens by divine action. God is in charge of it. The measuring line of chaos is a picture of dividing up land for a new owner. Let me get this back. Now, Isaiah talks, and we'll get to it in another place, about plumb lines and measuring lines. What is a plumb line and a measuring line? It is a string with a weight on it. And you hold the string up, and the weight will fall, and it'll pull the string straight. That's also used as an indication of God's righteousness, as the dividing line for God's righteousness. So this symbol here is this measuring line of chaos. God is going to stretch a measuring line out, and he is going to measure how far they are from his righteousness. And that measuring line is going to give them the chaos and the confusion. So the same word for chaos, confusion, is also translated without form and void. Where do you read those words? Genesis 1. God has decreed the desolation of powers that oppose his order. He brings disaster on those who have wreaked havoc on his order. Now, I have to tell you, I love this story, that God does not pay all of his bills on the first of the month. We don't see God's wrath come when we think it should. It comes when he is ready. So we may be living through tough times where we don't see his wrath. Well, one thing we know is when it comes, it's going to be awful. We should pray as many people as possible escape this wrath. Her nobles will have nothing there to be called a kingdom. And nobles are the special duties of life. These are all going to be things in the path, in the past. Duties of life. The nobles are going to have those special duties of life. So just like there are not going to be any human beings there, nobody's going to be, life will not return to the way it was. They will not have leaders the way they had them. The wrath is going to change life as they knew it. And all her princes will vanish away. So everything is going to change, isn't it? And Edom is just a case in point. Now here's another description of the totality of the destruction. Thorns will overrun her citadels, nettles and brambles her strongholds. She will become a haunt for jackals, a home for owls. Desert creatures will meet with hyenas, and wild goats will bleat to each other there in the night. Creatures will also lie down and find for themselves places of rest. The owl will nest here and lay eggs. She will hatch them and care for her young. Under the shadow of her wings, there also the falcons will gather, each with its mate. So this goes all the way back to the very beginning of the visions that Isaiah had of the destruction. And the same thing is going to come out of God's perfect wrath that was going to come out of just the destruction by the armies. Look in the scroll of the Lord and read. So the scroll is the book of the law. Probably it's going to be just the above prophecy that he was talking about in verses 1 through 15. The Spirit will see to it that what the Word says is fulfilled. And what did Jesus say about his life? He said that what was said about him must be fulfilled. Isaiah has the same view of, you know, what's written, that what's written must be fulfilled. None of these will be missing. No one will lack her mate, for it is his mouth that is given the order. Whose mouth? That's right. Before the ordering hand God imposed beauty, purpose, and fullness and order upon it. The created physical substrata of the world was meaningless, dark, and inhabitable and shapeless. So in the beginning, you know, the world was without form and void. It is to this which sin brings everything at the end. Sin brings the world back to disorder. It brings it back to the void it was before God imposed order on it. It is in absolute objection to what God has done. Sin wants to rule itself, and that's why the end of the world is going to be without people or purpose or shape or meaning, because the Lord himself imposes on a world of sinners that which they choose and achieve. For it is his mouth that has given the order, and his spirit will gather them together. He allots their portions, Joshua 18:10, as the Lord divided the promised land by lot, so he has distributed Edom by lot among the unclean animals. His hand distributes them by measure. All guarantee that the event will correspond with the Lord's word to be implemented by his power and come about by his personal touch. And they will possess it forever and dwell there from generation to generation. Joshua 18:10. So he's allotting the portion of destruction. This is a portion of destruction. Just like he allotted the portion of the land Israel by measure, and they'll possess it forever. This is a very heavy chapter. The next chapter is really joyful. So when we get to it next week, it's short, it's joyful, but it's got some messianic views in it, so I thought we would spend some time on that. And then you all need to decide what you want to do for the month of April. If you want to make up what we missed during March, we can. Or if you want to be gone until September, that's fine too.